Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll tag along on a count of unhoused individuals. The annual count requires getting out on the streets, but some argue it's not the best way to get an accurate picture of homelessness. Advocates are also calling for more money to help the unhoused. We'll get details on that. Fears of government raids and deportation have many immigrants fearful to leave home. It can have an impact on their health. We'll have a report. And students with undocumented parents are increasingly wary of putting much information on financial aid forms. We'll talk with the Illinois Farm Bureau president about what challenges the Trump administration could bring to Illinois agriculture. And we'll speak with a reporter who covered the trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Madigan was found guilty this week on some of the corruption counts against him. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, each year in January, volunteers venture into the night to count the number of homeless people across the country. It's part of the annual count directed by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and resources for homeless assistance organizations depend on it. But getting an accurate count is a challenge, especially in rural areas. The Midwest Newsroom's Kayvon Mansouri has more.
It's 1 a.m. and below freezing in a heavily wooded area behind a Dollar General in Jefferson City, Missouri. Icy snow covers the trail April Redmond carefully walks over. It's pitch black, except for the flashlight beaming from Redmond's phone.
I mean, there's a whole load of beer cans.
Up ahead, her flashlight catches what looks like a mound of trash. Some empty Miller High Life cans, cushions, and a tipped-over lawn chair sit covered in snow. Someone lived here. Redmond hopes the recent snowstorm or the low temperatures sent them looking for a warmer place to stay.
It's harder to prove their existence because they're more hidden. Like, we have people living in the woods in some places, and you would have no idea that they are there.
Redmond and other volunteers searched in Missouri's Callaway and Cole counties as part of the nationwide point-in-time count, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's annual tallying of the nation's homeless population. The count serves as an estimate and a guide for the government to decide where federal funding to support people without stable housing should go. Redmond operates Callaway Cares, a local nonprofit that helps people struggling with housing. Redmond expected several teams of volunteers to help tonight to cover the 1,250 square miles, but they ended up with only four people. They search abandoned buildings and fast food restaurants.
I personally think it's even more important that we track what numbers we can in the rural areas, honestly, because if we're not out doing this kind of thing, nobody knows that there's a homeless population.
Redmond knows an undercount is a problem, and that if they don't get an accurate number, the people struggling with housing in the rural Midwest could be shortchanged on services. It's a known problem. Jesse Rabinowitz is a spokesperson for the National Homeless Law Center. He says the point-in-time count is flawed because methods haven't meaningfully changed in a decade, and lawmakers don't act on the data that shows homelessness is getting worse in the country.
The central question behind the point-in-time should be, what do we need to do next year so that fewer people are experiencing homelessness when we go out and count them? Because if we're just counting people to get data, that's not sufficient.
Indeed, in 2020, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported HUD's methods of counting homelessness on a single night limits the number of people that can be tallied. In winter, people may be doubling up or tripling up in homes. What's more, the report says HUD doesn't offer enough guidance to local volunteers who perform the count, meaning counting methods throughout the country may vary. Rabinowitz says a recent surge in laws that criminalize camping outdoors in the country are driving people without housing away from visibility.
Instead of solving homelessness, cities and states across the country are passing laws that make it illegal for people to sleep outside.
Last year's point-in-time count data released in early January, a full year after the original search. The data showed homelessness in the U.S. is up 18% from 2023, and the population is the largest it's been since the count started 20 years ago. In Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska, the 2024 count tallied just over 15,000 homeless people. Some cities are trying a different approach to assist their homeless population. In St. Louis, Omaha, and Kansas City, a group called Community Solutions works with officials to track homeless individuals by name to match them with a housing solution. Adam Ruggie is the group's director for strategy and evaluation.
This is actually a problem that can be solved through housing and support in healthcare and resources like that.
Back in Missouri, volunteer Christina Willard enters an abandoned hotel and finds one person. Later, she and Redmond find three people at a McDonald's and give a man a sleeping bag and two blankets.
And one of them will quite literally be sleeping in the creek bed tonight.
In the end, they count 14 people overnight. They will continue counting at shelters over the next week. Still, Redmond says she knows there are people they aren't finding. For the Midwest Newsroom, I'm Kayvon Mansouri.
The Midwest Newsroom is an investigative and enterprise journalism collaboration. It's also a partner of the Trust Project. More than 16,000 people became unhoused in Illinois last year, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Eric Stock reports advocates say they need substantially more money to help break the cycle of homelessness.
Advocates from across Illinois have written a letter asking Governor J.B. Pritzker to add an additional $100 million to the state budget for homeless shelter services. That would mark a more than 30% increase over what the state currently spends on the unhoused. For many of the organizations, additional funds could help sustain or provide further housing for the increasing number of those without it. The increase in the homeless population is close to 20% nationally. Dreams Are Possible was one of the dozens of groups that signed the letter. The Bloomington-based organization provides career training and resources for women struggling to pay rent and obtain higher-paying jobs. Director Mary Campbell says many of her clients are below the poverty line and struggle with rent and other necessities.
It's only one bad situation that keeps them, that would make them move into being homeless. And actually, we actually have had and do have students who are homeless at currently. And they come to us from an encampment.
Campbell says her organization has provided a sense of community as well as training and a weekly stipend of $60. Campbell says it wasn't hard to sign on to the advocacy letter since so many people depend on the funding.
We see it up front and personal with the women and the struggles that they have to try to obtain adequate housing for them and their families. So it's a no-brainer for me to be involved in housing issues.
The Dream Center in Peoria is a faith-based nonprofit that provides career and education training, housing, and supplies for families and couples. The center's Christy Schofield says the cost of housing has been a key factor in why homelessness has been rising. That's why the Dream Center provides supportive housing for anyone in need. Schofield says the program helps people who have tried to leave shelters but struggled to find a more permanent home due to mental health issues or substance abuse.
They would lose that housing and they'd be back in a shelter, and it was just a cycle of homelessness.
Schofield says the additional funding is critical since it is challenging to run a dedicated 24/7 emergency shelter.
In the area, we don't turn anyone within our population away, and we have served as many as 190 at night. We serve 16,000 meals in August and September, and we are just struggling financially.
Dream Center's drive to help others through faith is similar to another signee, the Catholic Conference of Illinois. The organization helps craft and lobby policy for statewide programs involving the church. The conference also works with local dioceses to run charity events to help homeless and low-income residents. The Catholic Conference of Illinois' Social Services Director, Mary Lou Gervaccio, says her organization signed on because the church believes housing is a human right.
This is a concern for us when people are not able to afford housing and unfortunately are, living in without homes on the streets and so forth. And also because we believe there's a preferential option for the poor and vulnerable.
The request for more financial help comes at a time when the state faces a more than $3 billion deficit. State Senator Dave Kaler, a Democrat from Peoria, who represents parts of Bloomington Normal, says additional funding for shelters is necessary, but he knows it'll be hard to approve with so many budget priorities.
We just don't have as many resources this year to be able to satisfy all that 100%. So what we have to do is we have to prioritize and say, okay, this is what's most important. This, how can we spread out what resources we do have to make sure that everybody is taken care of a little bit.
The Illinois Shelter Alliance believes there's a cost to not providing help. A study from the Illinois Department of Public Health shows people experiencing homelessness cost the state $16 billion over 5 years. Homeless advocates say more money put into homeless prevention would save the state money long term. The report also shows homelessness lowers life expectancy by 20 years. With reporting from WGLT Capitol reporter Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
Governor Pritzker set to deliver his state budget address next week. Well, the news came down this week that former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was getting a presidential pardon from Donald Trump. Despite that pardon, Blagojevich faces serious roadblocks to running again for state office, getting a state pension, or regaining his law license. Dave McKinney has more.
When legislators impeached Blagojevich, they drove him out of office and also blocked him from ever holding state or local office in Illinois again, meaning no runs for governor, mayor, or the state legislature. Blagojevich never applied for a state pension, and state retirement system officials say, pardon or not, he remains ineligible for a nearly $65,000 annual pension. As for his law license, there are lawyers who got in trouble with the law themselves, had their slate wiped clean, but still face professional discipline. The Democratic-controlled state Supreme Court would be the final arbiter if Blagojevich seeks reinstatement to the bar. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
A new program at Illinois State University aims to get more fruits and veggies on the plates of students who live off campus while furthering the school's sustainability initiatives. It's a case study of what can happen when students imagine, then execute an idea. Riley Hickman is a grad assistant with the Illinois State University Office of Sustainability. In that role, she's managing the Redbird Fresh Market, which launched last fall. She tells correspondent Michelle Steinbacher the idea came about after students in a business course proposed the collaboration.
From what I understand, they gained like this feedback from students that there was kind of this difficulty for students who are living off campus, who don't necessarily have access to the dining halls, but don't live close enough to any of the grocery stores. So we kind of live on campus in what we call the normal food desert. So you can get mini snacks from like the convenience stores, but you don't really have access to fresh produce. I know we do have buses. You can bus all the way there, but it's a little bit difficult and tedious. So actually, whenever you pick up your bags, it's on campus.
How many participants did you have last fall?
So we had 130, which for a first semester was incredible. This is our first spring semester, but it will be available both fall and spring. A big selling point of our program is that it is $64 for the whole semester. For 8 weeks, you're getting a bag of groceries that's 8 to 10 produce items. And that's just like the items. So you might get like maybe 2 pairs, and that still counts as like one produce item. So for 8 weeks, you're provided with a huge amount of fruit and vegetables that is exorbitantly cheaper than you're going to get anywhere else. So we're buying the produce in bulk, and that we're not making a profit off of it. Whereas at a grocery store, they will be. There is that cost benefit as well, as you don't have to travel off campus. The price that you're getting at, truly, I believe, is unbeatable.
If you could talk a little bit about this idea that it's a student program.
Redbird Fresh Market is a program by students for students. The students do all of the ordering. So we choose all of the produce that's going to be in that bag. We are the ones dealing with the money and everything. And all of the students, the day of, we are putting all of that produce together into the bags. So at every step of the way, it is students entirely involved. Of course, we have the directors of the office who are watching and making sure that everything's going well, but they are completely hands-off, which I think is wonderful because it's all of students' inputs on what kind of things we're going to do and making sure that we're, you know, kind of keeping that business aspect of it, of like keeping track of the money, making sure that we are getting like the best deals for the people who are buying these bags.
And how do you get these low cost? Are you working with ISU's events management program?
So it's through Gordon Food Service, which is who EMDH, which is Events Management, Dining and Hospitality, who they buy all of their food for the dining halls and everything. So we kind of use that same connection. And we're buying in such large quantities that the produce is effectively cheaper. And again, we're not making a profit off of it, so there's not that profit margin that we're trying to make either. So we're getting it really low cost.
I'm Michelle Steinbacher, and this is Sound Ideas. We're speaking with Riley Hickman from ISU's Office of Sustainability. What do you get in a bag if you're a student? Like you said, it's 8 weeks, comes to about $8 a week, and you pick these up every Friday at the Bone Student Center, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would you get? What would be some of the items you might get in that bag?
We've had a large array of items. We usually try and split it 50-50 in terms of fruit and veg. And we also, whenever you go to pick up your bag, if there are some products in it that you don't want, you can switch it out. So we have like what we call a swap and share table. Some of the things that we've had recently, zucchini, guava, mangoes, cherry tomatoes, shallots, apples, oranges, bananas, kind of anything and everything. We try to keep it simple for like what students would like. I know a lot of students might not be interested in, you know, shallots or maybe guava. Like those items might be a little bit different for what they usually buy. So we try and keep it kind of simple and then have like one or two items that are kind of unique, but they can always swap and share it.
Maybe they can be adventurous and try to broaden their palate.
Exactly.
Or you have this share table where people can trade. What if someone doesn't come and pick up their food by the designated time?
At the end of the day, so we end at 4 o'clock on Fridays. And if people have not picked up their produce or if there's extra produce left on that share and swap table, we bring it to the School Street Food Pantry, who actually opens at 4 on Fridays. So it's kind of like a really cool thing to have it on Fridays where as soon as our program ends, they get all of that fresh fruit and produce. And I know that they're really grateful for it.
What is the role of the Office of Sustainability in this program?
I feel like we have a great knowledge in terms of like food, composting. Of course, we do a lot of the composting on campus. And so when we're packing these bags and we get bad vegetables and stuff, we know like how to compost. We're using paper bags, which are recyclable or compostable, all of the materials that go into these bags. So if you have like green beans, the bags that are holding the green beans are all compostable.
Riley Hickman, a graduate assistant with Illinois State University's Office of Sustainability. She manages the Redbird Fresh Market that launched last fall. More to come on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. For many immigrants in the Chicago area, the fear of being detained by law enforcement is already affecting their health. Hundreds of immigrants are skipping appointments and leaving prescriptions at the pharmacy since Republican President Donald Trump returned to office. Kristen Schorsch takes us inside a free clinic to show the chilling effect.
Margaret Bavis is a nurse practitioner. We're in an exam room at Community Health on the West Side, where she's treated patients for about 10 years. She calls a lot of them rock solid. They always come to their appointments.
The majority of patients that I see have diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. They have chronic diseases where they really need to be seen on a regular basis. So when I say that people are rock solid and they come in every 3 months for me to like check on them and adjust, if they don't come in, I get very nervous about what's going on.
And that's what's happening. Lately, some of her regular patients stop showing up. Bavis tells me about a patient who came in for lab work recently after skipping her appointment the week before. The patient was in tears. She was worried about getting caught up in an immigration raid and separated from her family.
And she's like, right now, I just am so afraid and I can't go anywhere and I can't go to the hospital. Like, I can't do anything. And it's just been very, very heartbreaking to just hear that kind of despair from people.
Community Health takes care of a lot of immigrants, and most of their patients are uninsured. In the first 2 weeks after Trump took office, nearly 30% of patients skip their doctor's appointments or lab tests here. That's more than 300 missed visits. There are other signs of their absence. During a recent visit to their pharmacy, I see two shelves filled with small brown paper bags full of prescriptions people haven't picked up for more than a week.
We have Janumet, which is for diabetes. So this patient and cholesterol medication.
That's Elsa Bishop. She's the assistant director of pharmacy.
So we also have insulin here for patients. So depending on how much they have at home, they definitely need these meds.
Providers don't have to imagine what delays in care look like. They've seen this before during the pandemic, when people skipped even basic care and got sicker. Many other clinics and hospitals say they don't keep track of who's missing appointments, but they are shifting to virtual visits for patients who don't want to leave home. There are other signs of the chilling effect of Trump's deportation threats. Immigrants are afraid to renew public benefits like food assistance and health care for their children. This has all happened before, during Trump's first term. Irma Barrientos is a program manager at Mano a Mano Family Resource Center in North Chicago. She says calls for help have dramatically dropped from
anywhere from 50 to 60 calls a day. And in these last 2 weeks, we'll receive maybe 3 to 5 calls of individuals looking to apply.
Fewer people also are applying for help to pay hospital bills.
We're going to have this vicious cycle of people having to go to the ER as their last resort and having these huge medical bills that everyone in America has.
There are helpers trying to navigate immigrants through all this fear. Community Health plans to open another clinic so patients don't have to travel so far for medical care. Bavis, the nurse practitioner, tries to keep perspective. She thinks about how her health center has helped immigrants before.
I'm not saying that I'm giving up hope, and I want to be strong for my patients and for my community, but I think right now, today, it just feels really hard. I'm worried about what's going to happen. I think sometimes with all the politics, people just lose sight of the humanity of people.
She says she's worried. This is just the start. Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ News.
An Illinois Democratic congressman has announced a bill that would prohibit federal immigration agents from arresting migrants in, quote, sensitive locations, such as schools, churches, and healthcare facilities. Jesus Chuy Garcia says migrant families should not have to live in constant fear.
We'll be seeking its passage, trying to instill in our colleagues across the aisle that there have to be bounds of decency in the enforcement of any laws and that you should not violate anyone's rights in a massive manner as is being purported right now.
Students with undocumented parents are weighing whether or not to fill out the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. Submitting the form unlocks help that pays for college, but it requires sharing detailed personal information about the parents. And there are heightened concerns over what the Trump administration might do with that information. Lisa Currian-Phillip reports.
I really wanted you to hear directly from students wrestling with this almost impossible decision. But you're not going to hear from them in the story. There's just so much fear right now. Students worry that even if they speak with me anonymously, their families will be targeted for deportation. It's the same fear they have about the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. Most students need to submit it to be able to afford college. It's the only way to get federal loans and grants to cover tuition and other costs. But filling it out essentially means telling the government whether or not your parents are undocumented. Carla Robles is with the College Access Group One Goal.
By law, this information is protected, but like that's right now, right? Like that's current fact. Like we don't know what will happen, and we also don't want to speculate.
There's a very real fear that the Trump administration might one day use the information students share on the FAFSA for immigration enforcement. Given the uncertainty, Robles says, her staff is not telling students to make one choice or another.
It's hard to tell a teacher, hey, basically tell students like it's up to you. Like, and students look up to these teachers for guidance, and it's like, but like, why aren't you telling me to go left or right?
But she says,
this is a deeply personal decision that students need to make with their families.
Idea Acosta is chief college officer for the Noble Charter School Network in Chicago and was once undocumented herself. She says, for students from mixed immigration status families, submitting the FAFSA has always been risky.
I have never believed that people's information was safe.
She says some of their information might already be on file with the federal government if they've paid taxes, for example.
You can ask DACA recipients, even if they were told that their information would not be used with other entities. Most applicants were well aware, right, that they were making a choice with some risk.
Acosta doesn't mean families can ignore Trump's threats of mass deportations. She tears up talking about the ICE raids that have made so many of her students fearful over the past 2 weeks.
They needed to assess like what risks they were taking and what benefits they could gain from applying for FAFSA, right? A pathway for a child to have access to college and transform their opportunities.
Fill out the FAFSA and risk exposing your undocumented parents to immigration authorities. Don't fill out the FAFSA and lose out on the opportunity to go to college.
I feel very passionate, committed to college access for Black and Brown children as the most predictable and sustainable pathway for our youth, not only to be able to find financial freedom, but to create positive multi-generational change.
That's why, despite the fears, so far, students are choosing to submit the FAFSA.
With financial aid, I think that I thought that we would see a decrease in applicants, but no, we haven't seen that.
That's Tanya Cabrera, chair of the Illinois Dream Fund. It's a scholarship program for undocumented students.
Students are like, I'm going to get my degree. Like, it's going to happen no matter what. And we're taking that risk. And the parents are like, you know, we came here for a better life and, you know, to be productive members. And if we can't do that, at the very least, we can make sure our child gets their degree.
Cabrera says students and their families are trying to do what they can now to prepare for a very uncertain future. I'm Lisa Corian-Phillip.
Illinois recorded more than $2 billion in cannabis sales last year. It's the fourth year in a row sales have gone up, buoyed by a sharp uptick in the number of items sold. Aaron Johnson, the state's cannabis regulation oversight officer, says prices are coming down, more people are growing, and more dispensaries are opening. The state collected $490 million in sales taxes from cannabis last year, about a third of which goes into the general state budget. The agriculture community is unsettled with tariffs against China in place and the first response by China already announced. Illinois Farm Bureau President Brian Duncan says they still hope the Trump administration's trying to make a deal with China, Canada, and Mexico. In this interview with Charlie Schlinker, Duncan says the picture is one of uncertainty because farmers know ag will be first on the list for tariff retaliation and the impact could be severe.
Meat exports, for instance. You know, last year, exports of beef added $400 to the price of a steer, $64 to the price of a market hog. We know about a third of our corn crop goes for export. The potential for exports of ethanol, the soybean market, export market is significant. Another thing that's a little concerning now is we've seen 2 years of declining farm income. And we have a farm bill that is stuck in 2018. So our farmers are facing 2025 prices with a 2018 economic backstop. That also adds to the challenging situation. And so again, we hold our collective breaths. You know, we were relieved to see that the tariffs on Canada and Mexico were paused for 30 days. And we really worked hard as an organization, as farmers, to pass USMCA. We believe it is a good agreement. You know, Farm Bureau believes in rules-based trade, and we were really encouraged when we received a positive ruling from the WTO on the Mexican GM corn dispute.
So Mexico takes about $5 billion in U.S. corn each year. Is that at risk?
I would hope not. I would hope that there is a resolution to be had. I mean, without the Mexican ham market, the pork industry, the hog industry is in trouble. This dispute with Mexico now seems to center more on foreign policy rather than trade policy. Immigration, fentanyl, all of those issues, and same with Canada. And so I would hope that that export market is not at risk. We're telling the story. We've been telling the story. You know, there was some frustration with the last administration. We didn't see any new trade agreements signed. We kind of stood still while the rest of the world continued to work towards trade. You know, now we sure don't want to be at risk of losing what we have.
So last time, China's soybeans went from 60% to 20% of U.S. sales and then recovered some to 50%, but it took 4 years to do it. What's the projected impact this time if it goes on for a while?
South America has more land. They can open up. Brazil does. China's made significant strategic investments, not only in South America, but also in Africa, as they look to build out a group of trading partners, people they can source agricultural products from. I don't know, but the risk, if U.S. soybeans become priced higher than any other soybeans in the world because of countervailing duties or retaliatory tariffs or whatever they put on them, then we know undoubtedly it will cost us market share. Will that be long-term? I think ultimately it probably will be, but that remains to be seen. So I don't know what is in the cards.
One thing that has happened and is in process here is the, as Elon Musk has termed it, feeding the U.S. Agency for International Development into the wood chipper. That might seem tangential to agriculture, but it's not, because of research, food aid shipments, creation of new markets through the soft power of development. How do you quantify that impact?
Again, it creates more uncertainty. You know, I was reading this morning, Charlie, about President Trump's buyout offer for federal employees. And what happens if we have a bunch of USDA meat inspectors take the buyout and walk off the job? You can't help but look around the corner and see, and I think that's my job, is to try to look around the corner and anticipate what's coming for our members. But we see some of these executive orders, a judge steps in and says it's an overreach. So the USAID effort, we'll see if that sticks. But yeah, that is significant, as a lot of our agricultural goods flow through that program.
Research conducted by USAID has benefited U.S. farmers on new varieties of wheat, new varieties of soybeans ever since the 1960s. How would ag seek to diversify its research sources if USAID goes away?
Well, we look to universities, but more and more, of course, research is in the hands of the private companies. You know, a lot of those private companies are not American-owned, if that's significant or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, I think some of the research on the large volume crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, that continues to find a home. What I have been told, it's in some of the specialty products that don't provide the volume, that the private companies maybe don't show the interest in, that are still very important to see new traits developed, new strains developed, that some of that research on some of them, if you call them minor crops, but they're not minor if you're growing them, is what will be hard to find a home with private industry.
The conventional wisdom was that the early part of President Trump's term, the first year or so, would be taken up with tax structure, regulatory stuff, and that the farm bill would be coming next year, yet another year's delay. And some Republicans are hostile to SNAP. Is that still valid? Is that still off a year?
There continues to be some behind-the-scenes negotiations. I don't know how serious it is. All I can tell you, Charlie, is what we are messaging is get to work on a farm bill now. Our members, our farmers, do not want this can kicked down the road another year. But I'm hopeful they can walk and chew gum at the same time, that we can work on multiple pieces of legislation. But, Charlie, you are right. There are going to be challenges probably on both sides of the political spectrum, right? The right of the spectrum will be wondering about the spend on food and nutrition title, and the left of the spectrum will be wondering on the commodity title. What we're hoping is for a middle pathway, but the reality is there's still going to be discussion about how you pay for a farm bill. And Chairman Thompson's iteration of the farm bill that came out of the House Ag Committee last year used the appropriated CCC funding as a solution to pay for the commodity title of the farm bill. And the challenge with that is we've needed those CCC funds to backstop agriculture in emergencies, because then if there is a trade war or if there is something develops that CCC dollars would have been tapped for, they won't be there. You know, so it is setting up to be a grind.
That's Illinois Farm Bureau President Brian Duncan. During the first Trump term, the administration made $27 billion in market facilitation payments to farmers to help make up for market share lost to the trade war with China. Duncan says the only talk he's heard about such payments this time was to a question during confirmation hearings for the new ag secretary, and she indicated support for the idea. You're listening to Statewide. We'll be right back in a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan was found guilty this week on 10 of 23 counts against him in a federal corruption trial. Madigan could be facing some serious prison time. Dave McKinney has been reporting on the sprawling investigation into Madigan for years, and he covered the five-month-long trial. He spoke with Mary Dixon.
This investigation ensnared dozens of Illinois politicians and lobbyists. How has this operation by federal investigators, how is it going to be remembered?
Well, I think it's going to go down in history, as at least in Illinois, as one of the most impactful ever. I mean, my level of consciousness in following political corruption in Illinois goes back to Dan Rostenkowski. And you think about him, and you think about George Ryan, you think about Rod Blagojevich, and now Madigan. Madigan is a little bit, I mean, they all had different, you know, amounts of power. They were at the top of their game when they were taken down, all of them. But in Madigan, you have this guy who just seemed untouchable his entire life, his entire political existence.
For decades, Madigan ruled with an iron fist in Springfield and in Chicago. He was always a little smarter than everyone else and much quieter than everyone else. So it was surprising to see this come to this resolution. When you look back on Madigan's career and on his legacy, how do you see this verdict fitting in with it?
Well, I mean, I think he took great pride in setting the record as being the longest serving speaker in American history in any state house in the country. But that's tarnished now. That's not how he's going to be remembered. Assuming that there is not a successful appeal in this case, he's going to be remembered for convictions, for corruption. And David Axelrod told me a few months back that this is going to be in the first line of his obituary. Whenever that day comes, people will, you know, he'll have that adjective in front of his name, convicted. And that's how he's going to be remembered.
This was a mixed decision, 10 guilty counts, 7 not guilty, a number of counts in which the jury could not make up their minds. So what is the sense you get from this mixed verdict?
Well, I think when you focus in on the 10 convictions, they all related to the ComEd case, which, as we remember from 2 years ago, 4 former ComEd executives and lobbyists, including Madigan's co-defendant in this trial, Michael McLean, were convicted of a bribery scheme aimed at Madigan. And jurors in this case seemed to really relate to that because the central players in that were it was sort of this rogues gallery of political cronies in Madigan's world who were successful at knocking on doors and being involved in his political organization, landing on ComEd's payroll, making hundreds of thousands of dollars to do nothing. And yet it happened at a time when the company was trying to get Madigan's support on legislation and successfully so. And so that was easy for jurors to relate to. The other piece of this case related to steering developers through corrupt former alderman Danny Solis to Madigan's law firm. I think that was a harder case to prove. Money didn't change hands to the extent that it did in this.
So will convictions like this, is it going to stop corruption in the state of Illinois?
Well, here's the thing. I just think that with every new generation of political leaders, they sort of forget the past lessons because they didn't live through them. And it's sort of like, you know, will there ever be another bank robber? And it's the same principle because, like, the next bank robber thinks that he or she is smarter than the last one. And I think that applies here as well. So and plus, you have state legislators and various governors over the years who they will say that they enact ethics reform, but it never really touches this because at the base, you know, folks can be greedy and corrupt.
Michael Madigan is 82. He faces some prison time on these convictions. Is that correct?
The most serious counts that he was convicted on carry a maximum prison term of 20 years. So he does face the prospect of significant prison time.
Will he actually go to prison for that long, do you think?
No, I don't think that's common. I mean, I think, you know, I certainly think if I were to guess, he's gonna get a few years of prison time.
Dave McKinney covers Illinois politics for WBEZ. He spoke with Mary Dixon. An Illinois state lawmaker wants professional sports teams to win before owners ask the legislature for money. Alex Degman reports.
The measure has bears in the title, but it applies to any team looking at state subsidies for stadium construction, maintenance, or renovations. The newly introduced measure from Democratic State Representative Bob Morgan requires teams to have at least a 500 record in three of their last five regular seasons. Morgan says that record wouldn't guarantee them taxpayer help, but it would be needed to get their feet in the door.
This is our message, I believe, from Springfield to say, before you even come down here, why don't you start by having a winning team?
Morgan doesn't think there's going to be a lot of stadium financing talk this year, given the state's other budget pressures. I'm Alex Degman.
President Trump's granting of clemency to more than 1,500 people who stormed the U.S. Capitol has some Jewish leaders fearing it could result in more violence by extremists. Maureen McKinney reports on what leaders in that faith community in Springfield are saying.
Springfield's Jewish community has not suffered violence as others in America have, but it's not immune. President Donald Trump's grant of clemency to 1,500-some people charged or convicted in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol has raised fears among Jewish leaders that it will embolden violence. Among them is Rabbi Greg Cantor. He leads Temple Brit Shalom, Springfield's oldest Jewish congregation.
We're concerned about the increase in anti-Semitism in the country and around the world, and it makes us concerned for our safety.
He remembers learning in horror of the white supremacist shooter opening fire at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in the nation's deadliest anti-Semitic attack.
We're increasingly concerned that if it can happen in Pittsburgh, it can happen anywhere. That's what we believe justifies spending more on security for organizations like ours.
A few miles away at Temple Israel, police are present at all events and electronic emergency buttons were installed in the synagogue, says Rabbi Arthur Stern.
Any Jewish person in our country today feels the repercussions of anti-Semitism throughout the United States and around the world.
In Illinois alone, there's been a 400% increase in anti-Semitic incidents, according to David Goldenberg, leader of the Midwest branch of the Anti-Defamation League.
ADL is deeply concerned about the blanket pardon of these individuals who were convicted of committing crimes related to the January 6th insurrection. We know the groups associated with the insurrection have a history of anti-Semitism, have a history of extremism, have a history of violence.
Among other crimes, insurrectionists from Illinois are accused of shoving police, spraying them with pesticide and pushing a bike rack and a flagpole at officers. In all, five people died as a result of the attack, which injured dozens of law enforcement officers and caused nearly $3 million in damage to the Capitol. The president has defended the decision to pardon and commute sentences of the insurrectionists, claiming that to weigh the cases individually would have been too hard and that the sentences were too extreme. That sentiment may have fueled an atmosphere encouraging white supremacists and extremists to incite violence. In Illinois alone, there's been a 400% increase in anti-Semitic incidents, according to Goldenberg. The rate has surged since the October 7th bombing assault in Israel and the ensuing political unrest over the Israeli attacks on Gaza and its people. An ADL audit of recent events will be released in the spring.
What I can tell you unofficially is that over the last 2 years, 2023 and 2024, we have tracked record levels of anti-Semitism in the state of Illinois. And these are acts of harassment, of vandalism, and assault.
There has been a surge in anti-Semitic incidents and white supremacist activities in college towns throughout Illinois, including Bloomington Normal, Carbondale, Champaign-Urbana, and Edwardsville. In Springfield, the white supremacist group Patriot Front in May posted anti-Semitic stickers, including those that said "No Zionists in Government." Flyers dispersed in Carbondale called for violence against Jews. bomb threats were made to a synagogue in Decatur. Those incidents were among about 180 reported in Illinois in 2024. Rabbi Cantor said he would like people in the Springfield community to visit his synagogue to speak up about anti-Semitism and report incidents to law enforcement.
When people know us, they're less likely to be swayed by anti-Semitic discussion and things like that, and they're more likely to speak up against it.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
After failing multiple times to pass, Karina's bill has now been signed by Illinois' governor. Mawa Iqbal has the story.
Karina Gonzalez, the law's namesake, was shot and killed allegedly by her husband in 2023. A judge had ordered him to stay away from Karina and her children, but he still had access to his gun and allegedly killed her daughter, Daniela, too. The law mandates officers remove guns from people accused of domestic violence within 4 days of a judge's order. Karina's son, Manny Alvarez, says his family has gone through some of the worst pain imaginable.
I hope that the future survivors won't have to suffer as much as our family and countless others have had to at the hands of abusers.
The law will go into effect in 90 days. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
In 2018, Haskell Elementary School in Rockford was deemed one of the lowest performing schools in Illinois. Now it has shot all the way to the top. Peter Medlin has more.
Kindergartners are writing code to add their face to a picture of a farmer surrounded by cows. They code themselves to bump into their partner and say,
"Look at all these cows."
Look at all them cows. Kindergarten coding activities are pretty common here at the STEAM Academy at Haskell Elementary School in Rockford. Haskell students get 45 minutes of special STEAM instruction every day, and that could be a Lego robotics lab or creating a stop-motion animation in their makerspace, like the animal movie these students are working on.
You can explore your own imagination. You do stuff that you didn't know you can do.
Pretty much you can make anything possible.
True that.
The STEAM-powered approach seems to be working, too. Haskell was just awarded an exemplary designation by the Illinois State Board of Education. That means Haskell performs among the top 10% of schools statewide with zero underperforming groups. But it wasn't always like this. Just 7 years ago, Haskell was in the bottom 5% of schools across the state. It was the year after they became a STEAM Academy. Lori Leathers is the principal at Haskell.
I think at the time we were like the lowest Rockford Public School in math. I think we had the lowest score. We just put math in the name of our school. Like, how are we gonna do that?
They originally made the change from a year-round academy to STEAM because they felt like they couldn't sustain student success.
Our children did not have a growth mindset. If they did something and it did not work, they were like, done. I'm not doing it again.
Leather says they needed a new focus. After visiting other schools, they landed on STEAM, but it was a rough start. They lost a lot of teachers when they switched their specialty. That's when they found themselves among the lowest performing schools.
I think 1 year we hired 8 or 9 certified new teachers. And so it was, I mean, when I say dire, I'm not even being dramatic.
It was really difficult to tell parents, just trust us, we're figuring this out, when it wasn't working. Especially since Haskell is a special program, which means parents choose to send their kids to Haskell. Students don't test in, but there's a lottery system, but they could just as easily send their kids to their neighborhood school. In fact, she says in the early years, calling it a lottery felt silly because they didn't have many applicants. Pretty much everyone got in. Leather says their performance now is built off of years of hard work and flexibility. They invested in STEAM training for their teachers, like Ryan Miller, who taught 5th grade and is now the assistant principal.
I was like, I don't really like science. She's like, you're at a STEAM school, you need to like science. So I spent a whole summer working on science and loved it.
They released students early every Wednesday for a year so they could do more professional development. For 6 years, they extended their school day. They hired a full-time STEAM specialist. Miller says they're also quick to switch up curricula if it's not clicking. But he says it's not just academics.
We really honed in on making kids feel safe in school and addressing social emotional needs. And that was huge when we were underperforming.
Miller says that's the foundation now. And it goes back to the growth mindset that Leathers mentioned. Kids feel comfortable enough to fail and to get back up and try again.
Like, growing your brain is supposed to be hard.
That's not just anecdotal either. In a student and staff survey, 2 of the school's top marks were for supportive environment and ambitious instruction. Leather says that's the key. And one of the things she's most proud of with their exemplary designation is that they have zero underperforming groups. It's not just a small group of kids with top test scores who buoy the whole school up. Low-income students are growing in math at the same level as everyone else. Students with disabilities are performing high above district and state averages. That's not common. And that lottery that felt silly a few years ago feels like a real lottery now. People want to send their kids to Haskell, and Leather says they have a massive wait list, and it's rare to see students choose to leave once they're in. And now other Rockford schools want to bring in STEAM too. Next year, West Middle School will start offering STEAM for its sixth graders. I'm Peter Mudlin.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. And be with us again next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.